Thank you all for listening to One Mic Stand. Do follow us on our Facebook and Instagram page. That is ONE_MICSTAND. Also, follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts with the same name. And last but not least, to all our groupies, we could not have done it without your support and feedbacks. Fuck yeah.
Selamat datang ke One Mic Stand. Hari ini kita ada dengan kita Lim Yubing. Selamat datang Lim Yubing.
Terima kasih.
How are you, bro?
I'm good, man.
Happy New Year, everyone.
Thank you. Happy New Year, everybody.
Happy New Year to our listeners, too. So the reason why I spoke in Malay is because from what I know, our Mr. Lim Yubing here can speak Malay.
Wow, start only put me on the spot. My goodness. Selamat Tahun Baru, everybody. Yeah.
That's it, man. So how are you, man? How are you?
I'm okay. But I have to correct you because I can't actually do it. You know, my good friend Rafat will tell you, he's Malay, koya, please lah, come on. Yeah,
he's a sastrawan. You know what's a sastrawan? Not?
No, but I know what standard of Malay he is. He's that very, you know, khas level. I cannot.
They should learn from Art Fazil. He's also good.
Yeah, I know. Two of them. Yeah. I don't know why I hang out with these two clowns. just to make my ego shrink.
So how are you? How have you been?
I'm good, man. I'm good.
And what have you been up to recently?
Well,
besides jogging and trekking and
what else? No, I only do that a little bit. But I've been filming. I mean, you know, filming has resumed for quite a lot of projects. Mm. And we have, you know, in Singapore, the broadcast professionals have put into place, of course, safety protocols to allow us to continue to work. So, you know, people work along those guidelines, and so far so good. It seems to be working in line with the national direction. So, yeah, I'm thankful that that is going on.
How many movies you got in the pipeline right now?
That's hard to say. I'm shooting, I'm on a TV series right now. And there's another one that I'm supposed to be doing next quarter. And other things are, you know, I've got one theater thing, a live theater thing, and other stuff is just in the pipeline of discussion, but no hard plans left. And you know, I'm a project worker, so I'm in the gig economy, so a lot of stuff you can't really say for sure.
Mm-hmm. And how do you actually start up with this, like this particular? How do I say it? Like, go into this industry, theatre, movies, acting. Is this a passion since young or what?
Yeah. So, I mean, I'm a bit of an unusual case, lah.
Unusual, eh?
Yeah. I think that's one of the more polite terms I've been called in my life. I've always been the weird one, lah.
Yeah.
So, I when I was in school, there were very few things that I was good at, and by the time I got to like O levels, it was pretty clear that I was a shitty student. Like, as far as the Singapore shitty.
Oh, shitty! Yeah, that's even worse than shitty.
Yeah, way worse. Shady somehow in Singapore you can get away with, but shitty cannot. So I was shitty lah. And by the time I got to that age, you know, like O levels, it was pretty clear that I was not gonna be able to progress through the Singapore system. Mm-hmm. Bear in mind, I'm born in 1965, so the system that was in place then, which is somewhat different from what it is now. And you know, things were looking pretty bleak for me in that direction. But as it turned out, I had an exposure to performing. My late mother was a dancer choreographer, mm-hmm. and so I'd actually, you know, it was a world that I was familiar with, and I had a sense for. And when I was in Sec 4, we did a big musical, and I was one of the main characters. And when I when I went on stage, I remember it just felt like, wow, everything fit suddenly. I knew what to do. In every other aspect of my life, or most aspects of my life, I didn't know what the hell to do. I was useless, pretty much, you know. And suddenly, all my skill sets seemed to be of use, seemed to fit this task I was communicating, I was able to touch people, you know, make people feel something, feel good, feel whatever. And I suddenly thought, wow, this is great. I actually feel like I'm doing what's right for me. This has got to be it.
Yeah.
It must be. I mean, I'm crap at everything else. This must be it, right? And so, but, you know, bear in mind, this is 1981. Yeah. So there were no avenues for me to pursue anything like that. There was nothing. You know, there's no LaSalle, there's no NAFA, there's no nothing. So a number of things were happening at the time. I mean, there were various, you know, amateur companies, amateur groups doing theater. And we didn't even think about TV at that time. TV was something quite far removed from our lives. You know, you thought of it as something that you only saw these one or two imported TV shows from the US. And, you know, that was what you thought TV was, right? So there were no avenues to pursue this study. And so I wanted to go and find a course of study. And you know, this is 1981. It was unheard of to go and study.
But your parents were supportive at the start, at the beginning of it.
Yes, okay. My dad said, look, you can study whatever you want. The only important thing is you have to learn how to learn. Once you learn how to learn, you got it. Okay, you can apply deep, that to anything.
That's the
you
thing,
can
I was
learn
just
anything.
Say that.
That's deep. You have to learn what you learn.
You have to learn how to learn. Yes. Once you learn how to learn, you can learn anything. You can apply whatever system of thinking you've picked up in education to whatever. And if you look at it, I mean, look, most of us out there in the world aren't working in the field that we studied necessarily.
Of course, yeah.
But you've applied something that you've learned in life or whatever to the thing that you're doing. So I think it's very true. And until today, obviously I still remember it because I just quoted it to you. But till today, I hang on to that. You know, I think it's important to keep learning. And so he allowed me to go, paid for my studies, and I went with the aim of learning everything I could to bring it back here to create a professional a world of theatre. And thankfully, at around the same time, there were a few other people with similar ideas, people who started Theatre Works, for example, you know, Lim Kay Tong, Justin Hill, Lim Xiao Chong, people like that, who had similar ideas, who were trained, and who, you know, while I was gone, they actually started a company in 1985, Theatre Works. Act 3 started in 1984. Yeah. So there were people who were doing this sort of thing, Chandran, Yasmin, you know, all making this happen. And so thankfully, when I came back, there was this scene beginning that I could then participate in. And you know, I spent the first half of my career just doing that.
So you started out in theatre first?
Yeah. Mm. Theatre is my base.
Okay.
And theatre is what I'm trained in.
Mm.
So TV really just, you know, it's, you utilize some of the same skill sets, but again, you learn how to learn, right? You go on set, you figure out what the systems are, and you learn how to apply whatever knowledge you have to that situation, and you learn from the situation. So TV came along much later. I mean, it wasn't until the 90s that you got
VR Man.
Local that you got local English drama.
Yeah,
you know. There was nothing like that before. And even at that stage, you know, much like what I call the emergence of the Singapore voice, we were borrowing from what we thought was best for us. At that stage, they were borrowing from Hollywood or, you know, whereas in the theatre, we had kind of already gone about a decade beyond that. We were trying to determine the Singapore voice. We had left the sort of post-colonial hangover, you know, and the times when all of our amateur companies and drama groups were just sort of putting up new versions of foreign plays or adaptations thereof, we were trying to bring the Singapore voice and Singapore writing to the stage and to the world, and to bring it outside and to show other people, this is our voice.
When you mention about Singapore voice, in a way you're trying to say that you're trying to find a Singapore identity of that
Theater. I mean, I think that sorry, when you say that, it fires up a lot of things, so I'm going to have to make sure I try and catch each one, because
you can
a few
fire
different,
me up all
no,
the way.
A few different strands. I don't think it's to find the Singapore voice. I believe the Singapore voice already existed, has always existed. Voice or the expression of a community is always there. It's just that we don't completely understand it or give it space to articulate itself, give it a platform. I mean, so back in the day, you know, anything English was, because of our colonial past, of course, was derived from the West. But people have been speaking English here forever, right? So we have our own way of speaking. Yeah. We have our own stories. We have our, look at the way we are speaking right now.
Yeah.
It's already this place, this time, Singapore, 2021, January. It's different from how it was 1 decade ago, 2 decades ago, 3 decades ago. The sound was different.
Are you in line with that? I mean, as we move along, and then when it comes to your theatre and your movies and things like that and your series.
Yes. So, I mean, this is our moment, the three of us. Yeah. This is our moment. This is how we are speaking right now. It was different then. And similarly, to follow yet another strand of the thing that what you said triggered off my head. When I'm working internationally, I don't always succeed. But I usually insist that I'm credited as Lim Yu Beng, not Yu Beng Lim. Because that's my name.
Yeah.
Hey,
they go the other way. Yeah.
Don't, you know, I appreciate that this is your way. But look, if we can be bothered to give respect to all the other ways of saying names.
Yep.
You know, if the world can learn how to say Schwarzenegger, they can learn how to say Lee Kuan Yew or you know, whatever, you know, Tanaka. They can learn how to say it. You know, we learn how to say Vander whatever, or
Habib
Dick Van Dyke, or Habib Nurmagomedov, right? Sorry, get off.
It's a tongue twister.
You know, I mean, we learn how to say all these things because they're in the popular sphere. And why can't we just make everybody learn how to say everybody else's name? Because honestly, it would make the world a better place. Because the beginning of respect is when I try to say your name right.
Yeah.
You know?
Exactly.
And you don't have to kind of give somebody your own kind of name for the thing, right? For the guy. So that's something that I try to do.
Was it easy for them to, you know, put your name as Lim Yu Beng, or was there a lot of
back and forth? It's not unlike how we have problems in our computer systems here, where you try and put in your name and it doesn't accept it, and you've got to do it this way. But that's not how your name is, you know, either in length of name or spelling or surname or son of or daughter of or whatever. And you find that the system doesn't allow it to. So sometimes there are those issues. But where it's managed by a human being, it's normally okay.
I'm just going to trigger myself and say something stupid. But
you
I'm
also
going to
trigger
it.
Also.
No, no, because normally I say something stupid and silly, right? But then I think this is a serious podcast. So I'm going to freaking go serious this time, man.
All right.
Okay.
Who are your regional influences or influence when you start up? I'm sure you look up to some actor or something like that.
I don't really think in that way. So I'm not a believer, for example, in fandom, you know. But certain people have certainly influenced me. Certain artists whom I've worked with, you know, Ong Keng Sen influenced me a lot. Christian Jit, and even though I didn't get a chance to work directly with him in any way. Just the philosophy of Ko Pa Kun, I think, has influenced some of my thinking. And these are all people from within the theatre sphere, Singapore, Malaysia, you know, that I've worked with. And so, yeah, their thinking. Keng Sen, you know, was my artistic director for years. And and he influenced me a lot. I think of those people. I think of the teachers that I've had, whom I learned a lot from. And nowadays, I look at all influences. I mean, I try to exchange fluids with any other artist that you jam with, that you disagree with, that you read about, that you talk to. Basically, if you and I are working on something together, I don't care who's senior, junior, whatever. We are equal on the floor. You get out there and you slug it out. And that's how we influence each other. And that's how we give rise to growth and to continuing to learn.
You know, you mentioned growth. I mean, comparing theater to movies, let's say. You think theater gets enough attention or funding from the government? Or in fact, okay, let's just talk about, does it get enough attention from people like, you know, me and Talib, you know? How do you make it as if the experience like you're going to a movie?
But I go for plays, you know that, right?
When was the last time?
1994. Okay. No, sorry, 1998.
I was waiting for the punchline.
There is. You know, people would rather go and see a movie than go and see a play. Yeah.
The last time I saw something was from Theatre Kami. I remember that, man.
Wow, that's great.
Yeah, it was 1998. Yeah, that's right.
What's the title?
Forgot, man. That's too long ago. Anyways, yeah.
I can't comment on what the government does or doesn't do for the arts. I will say, though, that, and perhaps it is admittedly my own journey and the things which I've encountered, I feel that the arts have thrived in Singapore despite and not because of the government. We manage because we have something to say and it's important to say, and that human beings are actually by nature innovative. If you stop treating them a certain way, you will see the innovation come about. And I actually think that that's what the arts do. To the other thing about, do I think that theatre gets enough airplay, so to speak? It's my medium, but you know, I totally understand that it ain't everybody's jam, right? So, I mean, you know, different people like different things, and it's like food, right? I mean, the fact that for some reason burgers have become universal food around the world is a direct result of history, colonization, trade, power, wars, etc., etc. But look, it has become so, you know. I was with my daughter last night and she wanted to go eat Shake Shack, so okay lah, you know. I'm not going to argue with somebody's choice of diet. And I do think of it as a diet. If you're the consumer, if you are the arts consumer, so to speak, if your preferred diet is Netflix, so be it, you know. And that's great and that's fine. I think that it's important that everybody has their choice. But the thing is, much like travel and much like meeting human beings and encountering human beings in a real way, you don't know sometimes what choice you have until you do a sampling. So I actually think it's good for people to try out different stuff, and you know, it's kind of like dating, right? I mean, you know, before you...
Do you think Singapore theatre can be, you know, that blown up and popular, like how K-pop, K-drama is now?
I don't know if that's necessarily theatre's place. And I'm not saying that it can't be and hasn't been. I think that there are products of differing degrees of popularity, even within theatre. So, for example, if I do a big razzmatazz entertaining musical, I know I'm going to get, you know, thousands more people watching it than if I do a deep, dark, small play in a small theatre about the anguish of a certain person. It's just naturally going to attract different audience members.
Yeah.
And different numbers. The numbers would be completely different, you know. So that doesn't surprise me. Just like in the movie world, you know, if you're going to do a, a, depressing little artsy movie about such and such, you know it's not going to get the kind of numbers as, you know, whatever, X-Men or whatever. Yeah. It's just not going to be the case. Neither one is good or bad or better than the other, but it's different diet. Some people want to go and eat that thing. Some people want to eat the other thing. Some people don't eat anything unless it's got sugar. And that's the way it is.
What kind of character have you not played and you wanted to play? Since you're talking about that dark character, you know, suddenly it sparks me to ask
that's an interesting question, man.
That is an interesting question. I've actually never thought about it. Because I suppose, by and large, I haven't. Oh, okay, yeah, okay. So, I mean, I think that I've never played, for example...
But you want to. Never played, but
I may have wanted to at that stage. Those days are long gone. I mean, I don't think I've ever been sort of like, you know, young romantic lead, for example. Okay. Even when I was younger. But I think that's also a type of role that most of us don't fit into or are not cut out for. And most of us as actors ain't gonna ever play. And that's fine.
Which one of us do you think will fit into that role?
You know, I think when you're old enough... No, I'm kidding. Yeah.
If you were to cast us in a play...
Oh, shit. This question again.
In a play.
In a play. Not in a movie. In a play. We start with play first. We play first. What roles do you think you cast?
Who will be the Prata Man?
Depends on... No, I think depends on the nature of the piece. I mean... It would be very funny, for example, to create a panto where you rub the lamp and instead of one genie come out, two of you come out and you are totally different. You know, one fellow grunts this way, one fellow grunts the other way, one fellow likes to sabo. I take your wish and, you know, and then give
that's
you back.
Double the wish, man.
Yeah.
2% double the wish.
Yeah, you might wish it never happened. Double whammy, man. Yeah. Partly because of the way you guys look as well and the kind of mischief that is in there. I think it could be great. I mean, it's you know, Bad Boys, Will Smith, that sort of shit, you know. It's potentially that, which is quite hilarious if you have somebody who wants just, hey, can you just please bloody grant my wish, get me around
bedazzled kind of shit. Have you seen bedazzled?
I'm terrible, I don't watch anything.
Oh, you don't, huh?
Yeah, but Brendan Fraser basically and, to befuddle the player.
What's the name? Liz Hurley and Brendan Fraser.
Now that you gave us the idea, I think we'll fund our own move play.
Do it.
Alright, man.
Do it.
But you spoke about Netflix.
But that one can become hit, a movie also.
You spoke about Netflix.
Hmm.
And recently there's a rerun of...
I don't have Netflix, but no, go on.
The other day when you said that... just now when you said something about Netflix, someone's watching Netflix or whatever.
Oh, yeah.
That recently there's a rerun of 999. Are you aware of this?
Yes, yes. I mean, the thing came out and suddenly I'm getting all these screen grabs from my friends. You know, not just 999, but all the stuff that was done back in the 90s, you know. My work in 999, my work with... I had a guest role that I used to do sometimes for Pachu Kang, you know. And all these things that my friends are sending me, like, oh my God, you got hair! You know, that stuff is just hilarious.
That's the next important question now.
Yes.
When you had hair in 999, how old were you?
So you really think people want to know this one, right?
Yes, there you go. They definitely will want to know that, man.
So... just
it was
give,
hair,
give
not
some,
weak, just to be clear.
No, it was hair. Yeah. I mean, just to give you a bit of context, 999 happened in 95. We ran for 4 seasons over 5 years. And I'm born at the end of the year. So we were shooting when I was 29. I was 29 playing a guy in his 40s with a teenage daughter. Which was quite funny. So I wanted to age myself. I grew the mustache. I grew the hair, you know, show the big lobang in the middle, did the comb over, chose the clothes from OG to you know, make sure, nothing against OG, by the way, guys, but, you know, just I chose the polo shirts, which I do not in real life wear, I detest them, but I chose the polo shirts because this is what the fella is going to wear, the styling and all that, so that I could appear old enough, because already when you hear my voice, it sounds... I sound like a kid sometimes, you know.
You have to make your voice
you know, deeper?
I didn't, because that's not a sort of thing you can really sustain for a whole series. But at least if you've got the visuals helping you, you know, it makes it a bit more believable. So even though the gal playing my daughter was only 9 years younger than I was, you know, it was fine, you know.
Was it weird?
I mean, it was. Yeah, well, it was a little weird at first, but, you know, I sat into it.
But you grew into the role, right? And then...
Well, I had a lot of references. I mean, I drew for a lot from, like, you know, the sergeant that I had in the army, whom I had such huge respect for, Sergeant Arthur. If you're listening, I salute you, Sarge. And I had these people that I looked up to that were like that.
Yeah.
So it was fine. But... bit of trivia. The funny thing is, that was when I was 29.
Yeah.
Now I'm 55. I'm still playing the guy in his 40s with a teenage daughter.
No, but the thing is,
doing
you
the same role for 25 years.
You look 42 when you were 29.
Yeah.
And now that you are of a certain age, you don't look your age. And I know your age now, and I'm.
Yeah. And what's the secret behind it?
Oh. Shave.
Are you trying to say that I look old? I don't shave.
but you know, honestly, because one of the first things you look at when you see somebody is hair, right?
Mm.
So you know, honestly, without the hair, it's a bit hard to tell, huh?
Mm.
So you know, the fact that I lost my hair.
Yeah, we're in the same boat, by the way.
Yeah, but just sort of eventually, as I was cutting hair shorter, after I asked, would I just shave the damn thing? And it just saves me a lot of trouble. And the funny byproduct is you can't really tell how old I am, even though the bones don't lie. The bones, I feel exactly my age, and I've always felt exactly my age.
So that's a secret. Okay.
Ooh.
So what is the next secret of you keeping your bald head nicely?
Oil. I'm a naturally oily fella. So I'm just, you know, everything shines. I frequently, while filming, have people come up to me, hey, sorry, it's damn bad. Can you go and fix it, please?
What?
And then someone will come and like powder my head because
really?
The bounce from the light onto my globe is like glare into the camera.
But I don't think it's as bad as, you know, Shamugam
glare. It's in that region.
It's more like Tarman. Not Shamugam.
Tarman, sorry. Yeah.
Well, I'd much rather be compared to one than the other, but that's not...
The Rock!
And you know what? I'll be honest with you. The first time when we got you, and then after that we were talking and saying that you're going to be on a podcast and things like that, I kind of got nervous.
Nervous?
Because, yeah, honestly.
Yes.
Yeah, I've got cold feet, man. I've got butterflies in my stomach. Because this is someone who's acted in Hollywood films and things like that.
And won quite a few awards, I must say. Over the years.
Well, I mean, if you're in the game long enough, now, you know.
And talking, since Talib brought up Hollywood, you did star in a Kung Fu movie with David Carradine.
Ah, yes.
Yeah, how was that like, man, with a legend like that?
I loved him. I have to say love because he's not with us anymore. Mm. But the man was so kind to me, and really, really took care of me. And I will always be grateful to him. He was very, very good to me. You know, the thing ends with a sort of showdown, because I was the main villain and he was of course the hero, so the final showdown is of course between him and me. And that fight scene took us 4 days to shoot, and by the end of it, I mean, I was so busted up. I think, looking back to what I was experiencing, I think I hadn't realized it, but I probably cracked a rib or two, but I didn't know it. But I was in a lot of pain. And he, you know, he has had a lifelong fascination with the martial arts, Chinese culture, etc. He himself, mind you, we were shooting in China.
Yeah.
Bagger made his own, like jamu, Chinese herbal thing, right?
Medicine, yeah.
He was making it himself. He made it for me. He said, my sifu taught me this.
Sifu,
guy's legit.
He's totally into it.
Yeah, totally into it. You know, use it, it will make you feel better. And I was like, what the, you know? And he said, I made it myself. I was like, wow, you know. it's kind of unbelievable, right? I mean, you know, I grew up watching Kung Fu, you know, in the 70s, you know. This is the guy. Now I'm in a thing with him. You know, he's my dad's age. We beat each other up on screen. And then he makes this herbal ointment for me to use for my aging body, which I was like, what? You know, but so grateful. And he was like that for all of us. He was very good to us.
And he does look like a soft-spoken guy, very nice guy.
Mm. He's opinionated and he's, you know, he's a character. But hey, no matter what anybody says, he was good to me and I will always be grateful.
What are your experiences like? Let's just start when you first got that call and you made your Hollywood debut. How would you be feeling? How did you felt back then?
Before we go into that, and I will answer your question. I think the phrase make your Hollywood debut is so misleading because...
But I mean, not many of our local actors.
Yeah, okay.
Even if we want to try to get into Bollywood, we can.
By the way, I got people to introduce you to later when you... Anyway, so... no, because the porn industry is really... No, I'm kidding. The phrase, your Hollywood debut, is potentially misleading. There are a number of these phrases that get tossed about quite easily. Things like, oh, you cross over to, you know, Channel 8 or whatever, you know, Channel 5. Or a lot of these terms are a little misleading. So, I mean, let's get real. Hollywood debut, bro, I'm still here. You know, I'm not there. Yeah. You know, and as someone who's part of the gig economy, it's just one gig. Mm. You get a shot at this, you take it, great. You know, I'm fortunate in that I've had a number of different gigs which have been international projects. I don't even want to say Hollywood. I mean, the only strictly speaking pure Hollywood thing really is Anne and the King. Yeah. Okay? But all the others, and there have been several international projects, are not Hollywood. But they are, yes, Western projects, American projects, British projects, etc., etc. But they're not Hollywood, but they are international projects, you know. So, but having said that, to go to your question, I was actually surprised because the process for that one was highly unusual. It was Anne and the King, 20th Century Fox.
Yeah.
And they only got me because Ivan Heng, who is another artist whom I'm very close to and whom I love, and have done a lot of work with. Ivan, who was trained in the UK in Glasgow, was friends with the casting director. And the casting director, you know, they were filming in Malaysia because you cannot go and film in Thailand. It's you'll be guilty of breaking the royalty, that rule about, you know, not speaking about the royalty. So... they were casting, looking for actors. And he said to her, darling, if you are casting in Malaysia, you would be making a big mistake if you don't look in Singapore. Because we've got a lot of actors who fit that bill. You know, they speak the language, meaning that they're all English-speaking, you can communicate with them easily. They're in the same vicinity. They look right. You should give it a look. So on his recommendation, she came. And if you look at all the people from here who were casting it, people like Kay Siu, Sui Lin, and so on, you know, most of us are actually theatre people. And so they looked at me, and then I didn't hear anything much from it. You know, I went for the audition, which is a thing unto itself, which I'll tell you about maybe another time, unless you want to hear it. And then they actually were looking at Keng Hua, and for a role, and she got called back, meaning next round. Mm-hmm. Next round, it was looking really close, and then So I thought, okay, you know, she's got it, and I don't have anything. I was on tour, touring a show in several cities. Show was going to Japan, Hong Kong, Australia, Jakarta. And while I was on tour, I suddenly got the call, hey, you got it. And I was like, huh?
After one audition or a few auditions.
So I never had to do the callbacks.
Wow.
Oh, okay.
So I was like, so I assumed I was out loud, you know. So I was very surprised. And it wasn't for something that I read for. In fact, there was no reading for specific roles. The casting director just had a sense that I was right for it. I was very surprised because I read the character description. It wasn't what I'm like. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a small, skinny, somewhat gender fluid man. And you know, this was written for a big, hulking, dangerous mofo of a warrior, right? And I was like, wow, thanks. Hey, that's brilliant. You know, I better go pump some iron or whatnot. And so that's what happened, you know. And so I was elated, to answer your question, but I was really also very surprised. And then King didn't get the role in the end. She was right down to the last two, and then she didn't.
How get many it. Auditions does one have to typically go to get a
I don't know that there's a typical answer, honestly. It depends on how they're casting, you know, whether it's a very large pool, whether they're already just going to certain names, or whether you're casting from a large pool and really like gather from the 300, you gather 30, and then from that you whittle it down to 6, and then from that you whittle it down to 2. It could be any number of ways, like, you know.
How many auditions did King Hua went through?
I don't know. I think probably 3 rounds of something, of casting. Yeah.
And you do fight choreography also.
I do fight choreography. Yeah.
Where does that come about? You are a lighting designer. You are a fight choreographer. What else? What else is there?
Yeah, that is a funny one. It's true. So it really came about from... Bear in mind that I come from what I call small theatre background. Mm-hmm. Small theatre meaning that it's like small company. La.
Okay.
Small company, you do everything. La. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I don't expect if I'm in a small company, it's just 3 of us in the room, I don't expect to have tons of like secretaries and various people to do whatever. If I need to photocopy something, I go and photocopy it, right? If I need to go and get copy, I'll go and get it, because small company, we do everything. And I still believe in that. If you read my bio, it still says at the end of it, I do this, all the things you listed, this, and whatever it takes to get the show up. Basically, I'll do what it takes to get the show up. And so this arose because there was a need for it. And, you know, in the world that I inhabited, that I was part of, the theatre world, there was at that stage, and we're talking about around the time I started doing this was maybe like 20 years ago-ish, there wasn't anybody doing it. And we didn't have anybody of that type, you know, who was trained to do that. I happened to have some martial arts background, not a lot, but I also had an interest in it. And I have an interest in staging things. I mean, I'm a director as well. And so I have an interest in making something, crafting something to look a particular way, to move a scene along, etc. And I've always seen fight choreography as simply a way to continue the direction of the scene, but told through action. So just as my words are my tool at the moment while talking to you, my body is also a tool. I mean, our listeners can't see, but I'm gesturing as I'm saying this. And in a scene with somebody, your body is a tool. So if you're not speaking, if you're, you know, in a fight, every punch is like a word, like a sentence. The punch is a word, the kick is a word, the almost is a word. It's an expression. And it becomes a scene. It has to work as a scene first, in my opinion. So that's how it came about. Because nobody was doing it, I just started doing it. And then one thing led to another, and sooner or later, everybody started to come to me to do that. But I never, you know, was a trained fight choreographer. It's just I had done a lot of stunt work in the course of doing shows.
Do you choreograph this with David Carradine or?
No. We had very good choreographers and so on, but we had fight choreographers. I think it was the guy who choreographed House of Flying Daggers, or I can't remember now. But I mean, all these people are, and I love to watch, you know, great fight choreographers work. I'm just a working Joe that happens to do that sometimes.
So who's your favorite Kung Fu artist?
I don't really have one.
Bruce Lee.
Of course, Bruce Lee, you know, is one.
My favorite is Tompo.
Okay. Big fella. Very big fella. I like watching Jason Statham. And I like Mark Dacascos because he's one of the few Western guys who very early on was not fighting like, forgive my using this language, but not fighting like a white man. And by that I mean it wasn't
just
throwing
thing.
These sort of haymakers, right? And with you know, so everything becomes rah-pack. He was agile, is agile. He's still working. He's still great. You know, he's like a Jason Statham or whatever. But that wasn't how white guys were supposed to fight in those days, right? It just wasn't. It was all about brawn. Yeah. You know, if you couldn't fight in your cowboy boots, you weren't a real dude. You know, and I think we've learned now, and thankfully we've got MMA, which shows people the kind of agility that's required to really do something. You know. And so you've got a whole, by now, two generations already of fighters who are agile, who are not your hulking creatures, you know, and I think that's fascinating.
One mic stand. Thank you all for listening to One Mic Stand. Do follow us on our Facebook and Instagram page. That is ONE_MICSTAND. Also, follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts with the same name. And last but not least, to all our groupies, we could not have done it without your support and feedbacks. Fuck yeah.
I want to ask you this. Mm. You know, when Asian actors or actresses goes to Hollywood, most of the roles they get are really stereotype kind of roles. What is your view on this? Has it changed?
I think it has changed. And of course, we can all point to various markers along the way. But it's very much, I mean, if you look at the scripts that I used to see back, you know, in like 90s, early 2000s and so on, if you were seeing an Asian character in a Western vehicle, the chances are it was the Chinese gangster or the Japanese businessman or the Korean shopkeeper or etc., etc. They were actually written as those characters to fulfill a particular image that the West has of those characters, or of Asians in general. But if you look at the roles, which, you know, I frequently help King prep for stuff, auditions and things like that. And of course, I go up for a lot of these auditions as well. You look at a lot of these roles nowadays, I'm Asian, she's Asian, obviously, you know. You could be auditioning for a character whose name is Mrs. Williams. Doesn't matter. You know, or whatever. You know, Darian Faye or whatever, I'm making these names up. Doesn't matter. They are looking at the character, not just your ethnicity. And of course not all roles, but increasing numbers of them. So they are, which points to a number of things in different places. In their society, I think what it points to is the acceptance that we, meaning they, are a multicultural, multicolored society, and that there are amongst them many people of many colors who are, for example, American, and just as American as the next person, and who could play these roles easily because it's not written as an ethnic, as a role of a particular ethnicity. It's written as a character, someone who has this to hide, someone who has this agenda, someone who has this whatever. And so it could go to anybody. So that's a good recognition on their part for their own society. I think what it points to for us is that in terms of opportunity, of course, it means that you no longer have to play those stereotypes, which a lot of us may not even understand. I mean, what do I know about being a Korean shopkeeper in downtown LA? I don't know anything about it, you know?
Yeah.
But it means that now I can play just the character, which for most actors, you can only do, sadly enough, in your home country.
Yeah.
I, in Singapore, get to play characters of varying types, you know, father types, whatever. In most of these, for example, US movies through the years, I've been playing killers,
yeah.
Mercenaries, etc., etc. I'm not going to be playing the sensitive daddy type in most of their vehicles, but one of my friends who's over there just did a role like that, you know, and he's been there for a long time, and he said it's refreshing that now we're just as eligible. Yeah. So, yeah, but that's a whole nother conversation to have, because there's a lot of different views about the Asian American, are they Asian, are they American, etc., etc. It's a whole conversation in itself.
A birther issue.
The what?
Birther issue. You remember when they were saying that Obama wasn't born in the States?
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Talk us through this movie, Solos. It's got some good reviews about it. It's got some flags about it, and Singapore government kind of like restrict certain portions of it.
Yes.
And yeah, what is it about, man, in your head? And
your what is it about? It?
Yeah, I mean, like, what do you think about it? What do you think about the end production and what you actually did with the movie?
Gosh, so many things to say. And you know, bear in mind, most people haven't seen it, so they might not know what I'm talking about. But maybe they'll go download it after this, and that'll be great.
They should. Movies123.com.
Say it again.
Nah, they heard it the first time.
Okay. Solos, written and directed by Lu Zihan. Sorry, that sounds wrong. Lu Zihan. Okay. A friend of mine. And I, we playfully call each other boyfriend. Whenever I say, hey, boyfriend, you know. So he wrote this movie, and he and Khan Loom sort of co-directed it. But I think when we went to final edit, he pretty much took it over and did the final edit. Is a sort of art house flick done in about, I think it was 07, if I'm not wrong. And it's essentially three characters.
Yeah.
The boy, who's the central character, we call him boy, so he, like A-level sort of age.
Yeah.
Man, who is his teacher as well as his lover, and woman, who is his mother. So these three characters, and it's, when I say art house, I mean it's non-realistic la. You know, if you watch it, there's moments which are, I think for lack of a better word, very, very theatrical.
Yeah.
And it's not meant to be, this is realistic, you know. Although there are scenes of very gritty realism. Already by saying that, you know, it's boy and his teacher who's a lover, you can see there's an issue.
Yeah.
And it's shot in a style that is very non-gratuitous, by which I mean it's not designed to make you feel good and wow, warm and, you know, like, oh, wonderful, warm, loving sex. I want, as a viewer, I feel like I want to participate. It's not that.
Yeah.
If anything, I think it's got a very steely, cold feel, and it leaves you with a certain taste in your mouth, and that is, I think, the desired effect. You know, when you say what do I think it means, which I realized actually later was not what you meant to say. I just wanted to answer that and say that as an artist, I always feel it's not my job to tell anybody what something means, because I would be robbing you of your choice, of your opinion about the work, you know. And I always feel that people should, I go back to sampling lah.
Mm-hmm.
Better you sample and then you decide what you think, what you like, what you don't like, rather than I tell you this is a, you know, it's like drinking wine or what, you know. Do I believe all the reviews, or do I just drink the damn thing and then tell you what I think, you know, or watch the movie and tell you what I think, you know. So we did that, and it was I think the story behind it was, if I recall, that it was going to be premiered at Filmfest. And gosh, I don't know if I can say these things. Well, what the hell? It's 07.
Just go ahead.
You know, the
and make our day.
I think that the nature of the work is such that there were a number of scenes which had sex in them.
Mm.
And, you know, there's male-to-male sex. And, of course, male-to-male sex is highly frowned upon in Singapore. Yeah. It's still illegal in this country, technically. We still have 377A. What the hell we're doing with that, I don't know. But some clown up there obviously thinks it's a good idea. And so it was... they said that we could only screen it if these three sex scenes, these three scenes which they called were sex scenes, were removed.
Yeah.
All of which were male to male. And, you know, Filmfest and, you know, hats off to Filmfest for having some integrity.
The balls, you mean?
Yes. Said, we will not screen something where the artist's work has been compromised by censorship.
Wow.
That is not our policy. You know, we'll screen in its entirety or we won't. Mm. And so they said, well, then you can't. It's banned in Singapore. If you're not going to make these changes, and if you know, if you're not going to cut these scenes, then the film has to be banned. And so they said, so be it. Oddly enough, one of the funny knock-on effects of that is that thereafter, it became the film that was banned in Singapore, right?
Yeah.
Which I think added to its appeal for people who are buying it on Amazon or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, this film was banned in Singapore. So in a sense, we find out something about Singapore, we find out something about art making, we find out something about this world that is in the film. And it sold rather well and did very well in, again, lesbian film festivals around the world.
Yeah.
And Sir Ian McKellen actually, I think, has the foreword in the if you buy the DVD, gosh, nobody buys DVDs anymore, but you know, Sir Ian McKellen actually gives a foreword to it.
Yeah.
You know? So I think in a strange way, it kind of spoke well of the film. And I think it speaks rather well also to the integrity of Filmfest and of art makers in Singapore.
Do you think you've achieved something out of it as an artist?
There's
an impact that came out from you.
For me personally, and bear in mind, I'm not one of those decision makers who was involved in that whole process I just described.
So I mean, I can't as yourself,
but,
as an actor.
But as myself, yes. Because for me, you know, we're all going through different stages in our development, whether it's in career or art or child rearing or relationships. We're all going through different stages. And at that stage of my career, I was actually going through a very odd stage because I had always been known as the anal, kiasu, super over-prepared, warm-up for the warm-up kind of guy.
Anal is not the right word to use for that description of the
Well,
movie,
actually, you know, maybe it was correct. But anyway, yeah. But, you know, either side is fine.
You're just purposely saying it.
Yeah. But you know, it's literally true. I mean, like, if warm-up is 8 a.m., I'm normally there, you know, 10 minutes before to warm up or 20 minutes before to warm up so that 8 a.m. I can do the warm up properly so that 9 o'clock I'm good to go.
Okay.
You know, it's this kind of kiasuism, right? And I think that the problem is that when I look at the work that I did, sometimes it was a bit too studied. It was too deliberate. You can see the actor working. You can see the choice making going on. Something's wrong there. So I was actually on a whole drive to try and relax, don't prepare, trust. You already have it so ingrained. You understand what's going on. The processes are in place. Trust the process. Release, let go, be free. Hantam, in a sense.
Yeah.
Jam. And so I was going through that. So I approached this one totally differently from everything I had done up to that point. I would deliberately, I mean, of course, I knew the script inside out already, but I would deliberately go on set and just not plan anything and just improvise and just go with the flow. So all the you know, for example, like lovemaking or whatever you see in there, it's spontaneous. We didn't know what was going to happen. We didn't know
when it comes to making, it's always improvisation.
Exactly. And human interaction generally, aside from formality and rite and ritual, is improvised. So when you learn how to improvise, whether you're a musician or an actor or whatever, you're actually learning how to jam with life. In bringing up my daughter, I constantly go back to this. I am convinced that I have done practically nothing by structure and everything by improvisation. And that's how I've managed to always be present with her. Because I'm not going by a book. I'm not going by a set of rules that some other person has laid out simply because it was right for them. I'm going by what I can sense from her and what is right for her and what is right for her and me now in this place, in this time, with this situation that sits before us.
What's the difference between actors back then, be it theater or TV, and now? What's the big difference you see?
I don't know that I can honestly comment on that. Because I'm still in it now, and I'm at a different stage in my life. But I will say that when I look at some of the shit that we did back in those days, I mean, it was crazy, you know, and you're working without the benefit of any sort of like welfare or safety management, or, and not just actors, everybody in, you know. So I was a tech guy, right? I was the technical manager for Theatre Works for 5 years in the time that I was with them. And I would mount all these shows. We did shows in a quarry. We did shows in whatever. You know, it's not like today where you've got all these safety regulations. You know, I would be hanging, 30 meters off the ground by one arm, fixing a light with the other.
You were saying you did shows at a quarry.
Yeah, so we really? did a show in the dairy farm quarry. You know, I would have no labor. Go and do it all by myself, you know, catch snakes, shit like that.
Catch snakes?
I mean, because there's snakes.
Shit.
There were snakes in Fort Canning as well, where I used to work. So there's basically no safety. No safety harness, you're hanging off a building, whatever, too bad, right? And similarly for the actors, I mean, it was just, you get injured, that's on you, you know? And it's completely different from today. But I think that the passion was so deep and so strong. I don't know if any of us could really articulate what it was, but we were so deeply in love with what we did that we would have done anything for it. And we did. And for that, we withstood, hardships and lack of funding and all sorts of things. You know, I've got friends who, we were on stage together, people broke bones, had nails go through their foot, whatever, carried on, did the show, not a peep, you don't
Is
see
it. Is it because of all this that 999 became a hit and VR Man became a flop?
No!
We're getting, I tell you what, we've always been speaking about VR Man. We've always been speaking about James Lai. We're going to get to him one day. We're quite close now.
We want to get him on our show. Please,
yeah. We're quite close now. That we got
he'll
you
never
here.
Come here. He'll never come here.
He'll never come here. What the?
No. I tell you, the sad thing is that no matter what you do, whether it's genius or complete foolery, if you are the actor, you are the fella that is going to be remembered forever and ever as you are the one whom people are going to pin the blame or praise on. You know, it may be a great product and it was because of great direction, but they will remember the actor. It may have been a terrible product and terribly conceived and you just had to do it because you were on a contract, but they'll remember the actor. And that is your thing to face, whatever it is.
Just like a podcast, we mentioned this so many times before, in private, of course.
Yeah.
If the podcast is good, right?
Yeah.
Everyone will speak about, hey, this guy,
the guest.
They're not gonna
think about the fellas who crafted it, who prodded in the right direction.
Yeah. Correct.
Exactly.
Yeah. And we're okay with that, but if the podcast is bad, you fucking idiots, you mess up.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
Of course.
Really, I mean, like what Talib said, we are okay with all this. Yeah. We only cry ourselves to bed and night.
Wine see? For the next week.
You need to have your own show.
So wait, there's another thing that you do and not many people know. I recently saw this clip on YouTube with Nisa Anwar.
Oh my gosh. Yeah,
you were biking, man.
Yeah.
And I found out that you bike quite a bit and you travel with your bike.
Yeah.
How many bikes do you have now?
I've always only had one bike at a time. I mean, in my long life, I've had, you know, 7 bikes, but I only ever have one at a time.
Okay.
And I don't actually travel with my own bike all the time. It depends on what I'm doing.
Okay.
You know, so for example, 2019, I was fortunate enough to do a trip up the Himalayas from the India side.
Okay.
So that was on a rented
Royal Enfield. Were you on a Royal Enfield?
Royal Enfield,
yeah,
Himalayan.
Yeah,
which is the perfect bike for that trip. And yeah, you know, you certainly wouldn't have wanted to go up there on what I ride. It would have been inappropriate for the terrain and for the altitude, etc.
Sorry to cut you off, but I've always wondered about this. I've seen that trip. I've thought of going on that trip.
You gotta go. It's brilliant.
That's the thing. I was thinking, will the Royal Enfield bring me along the route that I want to go? Or do I use something like a...
Off-road.
Maybe a GS.
No.
A 650.
No.
Things like that. It keeps on going in my mind. But you've done it before.
No.
And
I would
you can
strongly,
tell me now.
Yeah. First of all, I would strongly advise, and of course different people have their opinions, there are some people who really want to go up there and do it again, but this time on an Africa twin. I'm like, what lah? For what? Honestly, the Himalayan was all I needed. 400 cc's, it's not overly talky. You're never going to get into trouble. You're never going to overshoot and go fall off a mountain. If you want to go up there, you know, with such big guns, you better know how to control it, huh? You
maybe
better
a 650.
650 is the max I would recommend for that.
Okay.
If you're going there on a 650 that is a designated bike for that kind of terrain, okay, conceivable. But honestly,
I don't think
you need it. Well, you're going from tarmac to rocks to snow to mud to sand.
And that bike can handle
that's
everything.
That's the thing. I was really like, what?
And sometimes all at once. So you're on snow and sludge at the same time and whatever, you know, and cow shit, which is very slippery, by the way. and you know, you don't want to go and face plant in that one, huh?
If you're
enough of a clown, you will face plant in that. So, you know, it's really, you've got to be on the right bikes. And having said this, there are people who do it on what I would not consider to be the right bikes. But they manage. I mean, our guide, for example, was riding a Bullet. Okay, that's not designed for that terrain. It's a very, you know, street chopper. But he's so damn good. He was just, and we were looking at him like, how the hell do you do that? So I tried it.
Yeah.
One day I said, hey, let me try that. I was fishtailing all the way, every corner I was fishtailing.
Really, yeah?
And
wow.
You know, it's mountain, so it's just corner.
Yeah.
I was fishtailing every corner, man. But he just made it look easy. You know, he was berming all the way. But I was like, oh, I don't know how you can see through your ass and plant the berm so well.
Yeah.
But he was doing it now.
Do you film it?
I didn't. I mean, I'm not that good.
Man.
Some people,
have, huh?
A lot of people on our ride, and we've got tons of photographs and videos and stuff from that ride. And I went out with some good people, so... but it's I think it was the perfect bike. I mean, as long let it be the right bike, ideally. And I mean, it's traveling, you know, rough and ready, like, be prepared, you know.
Were you alone?
No, I didn't know anybody in the group,
yeah.
But I obviously got to know them very quickly on the ride, like,
yeah.
And we're still friends. We hang out, you know. So there was about 8 of us riders. 7 of us, and we went up as a team.
Besides the Himalayas, describe what you saw and your experience there. I mean, we spoke about the bike, yes, but the journey itself.
Every time I do one of these rides, and I do love my touring rides, and I've ridden to quite a lot of places, it's a lesson in humanity. And bear in mind that I'm in a business where my currency is actually humanity. I don't know any other way to put it. The thing that I am trading with, in a sense, is the ability to be human and to be real and to feel and to all those things which we don't put value on. That happens to be the currency of my trade. And every time I do one of these trips, it is a lesson in that, you know. And tell you something as simple as riding from Singapore to Thailand, okay?
Yeah.
Which you can do in a day. You go, you look at the people you see, just look at the faces. You see the faces change. You get to North Malaysia, the faces change, accent changes. You cross the border, you see the faces slowly, slowly change. You're going through Southern Thailand, the faces are changing, the terrain is changing, the sounds are changing. Borders are just human beings trying to be assholes and you know, draw lines. Lines don't exist. Lines like that don't exist in nature. Everything is gradated. Mm-hmm. You, even if you do draw a line, you go close enough, you see it's pixelated. I want to see every bloody pixel in the picture. You go and see the faces, face change. You ride through the India, and we went through, you know, the mostly Hindu parts of India into some Muslim towns, you know, up and in, into the Himalayas. You see the faces change. Some places you think you're in Afghanistan. The face,
like Ashraf, you mean faces like him,
and fairer, redder, eyes green,
dyed beard.
Or if not dyed, it's a natural color.
Yeah.
All this sort of thing, and it's all India. Mm. And you're watching the faces change. You're hearing the language change. You're smelling the food differently. It's amazing, and you you become very conscious of how actually it's just politicians who screw it up. Honestly, all this, the land does not judge. The people just are who they are. And you watch it change, and it changes you. The terrain changes you. The view changes you. And what you are able to see of yourself changes you. And I think that's what's valuable to me now.
Has King Hua ever followed you on all these trips, or one of
no,
these trips?
No. She's got her own thing. I don't know if you know, but King and I are very close, but we're divorced. So we got divorced in 2017, and we remain very close. In fact, I just had a long video call with her today. We're very close, best friends, and we remain very, very, you know, close and committed to our daughter. We're divorced and remain what I would call family.
Any advice you want to give to aspiring actors, actresses that wants to go into, you know, TV, plays? One tip that you can give them?
I don't know if I can give my own tip, but I would love to quote two tips that I was given. Mm-hmm.
Well, that first one was brilliant, man. You got to top that one up.
So my father saying, learn how to learn. The other one, maybe I will give you one of mine later, but the other one is actually, I told you I was like worst boy in school, right? The loser, the failure, the whatever. And my then headmaster, and back in those days we still used these terms, very English, called me enough after, you know, I'd already graduated and I was going to pursue my studies overseas. And he called me in and you know, into his office, and you know, every time that I'd stood there as a student, it was to be gained or what lah.
Really? And you're that bad?
or at least accused of it. I've been wrongly punished before. But anyway, which shapes my view of authority.
You should have acted your way out of that.
No, cannot. Ironically, acting is about telling the truth. And I stood there, and suddenly it was a different context. And he said, I understand that you're going to do this, you know, go and study this course of study. And he said, I just want to share with you something, which is that it's not all bright lights and you know, applause. There's going to be days, in fact, probably most of the days, where you are doing something quite other than that in order to get to the thing that is your goal, whether it's the bright lights and applause or whatever. And you must remember that that is part of the journey. You cannot have the one without the other. And I said, thank you very much, sir, because I already was discovering this to be true. And so that is why I say I'll do whatever it takes to get the show up. In a lot of theatre culture, in Singapore as well as in other parts of Asia, especially when you look at traditional theatre, which I've also partaken in, thank God, you as the disciple or artist or minion or whatever, before you start work, you take the cloth, you mop the floor with your hands, on your hands and knees. You mop, you clean the space, you sanctify the space before you step on it. It also kind of puts you in the right attitude towards your work. And I think it's important for us to remember that, you know, you've got a lot of work to do to get to that thing. But it is part of that thing. Because, you know, you only see the iceberg, huh? There's a whole other thing under the water. And it wouldn't be there if not for all this. And your job is to create all this, because only at the end of it does this part show. Yeah. You know,
it's like a mountain.
Yeah. So all the this packs. Is your job.
So there you have it,
Mr. Lim
Yubing.
Okay, if you want my word of advice to them, I would say love it. Love, and that will motivate you.
There you go. Love it, and love one mic stand.
Thank you, Lim Yubing.
Thanks, guys.
Appreciate your presence here. I mean, the whole thing is an exhilarating experience.
I still can't believe you're in front of me. Really.
You know what? When we speak to people, we speak to a few people. Hey, we got Lim Yubing on the show next. They're asking who's next, and we got Lim Yubing next. Wow, I love that guy, man. No, really. And then they got mixed up between Lim Yubing and Lim Kay Tong. I said, no, Lim Yubing, 999.
Yeah.
I love that guy, man. This one should be, you know. So there you go, man.
Thanks very much, guys. And to our listeners, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good night.